From Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields has an in-store nutritionist, provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. Thanks for tuning in. Today, listeners, we welcome your questions for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. If you'd like to talk with Susan, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. You will find her on the web at www.eatandmove.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Hi, welcome back.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
Good to see you. Where do you want to begin today?
Well, I thought we'd talk a little bit about cardiovascular health, because it seems to me I keep getting lots and lots of questions about heart health, and a lot more clients coming in all the time trying to decrease their blood cholesterol levels, perhaps naturally or even along with medication, but trying to bring them down even more with foods that you can eat, and certainly looking at what you should and shouldn't eat or what you should eat more of. That really seems to be the area we're seeing more interested in. What foods can you add that are going to help? So we can talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. Well, I brought a handout that we can make available to listeners after today as well, and it's something that I put together just, you know, talking about your nutrition plan for high cholesterol if you do find your lipids are high. And, of course, we're finding that more and more people do have high cholesterol, and even it's been really interesting. A lot of collegiate athletes I've been working with seems more and more as we test them their freshman year coming into college, often their test just a full lipid profile, perhaps the first time they've ever been tested. I've been working with more and more students at that age than I ever have any other year. So it's been interesting to me. I think we're seeing perhaps more familial. A lot of these athletes, certainly it's not what they're eating necessarily. It's the fact that they might have just predisposition to high lipids. And so looking at what you can do, even if you are fit and you're staying lean and you're doing all the things exercise-wise, because we certainly know that that's a big part of it as well as staying active. But, you know, we talk a lot about fats and watching fats and kind of cutting down on your total fat. And really the shift there has also been make sure you eat fat, but get more of these good fats or maybe more monounsaturated fats. Things like we've had some studies on nuts and the benefit of nuts and even a quarter cup of nuts a day, which isn't that many nuts, actually, when you sit and look at how much that is. So you don't want to eat tons of nuts and get all the calories. But particularly things like almonds and walnuts and nuts that may be beneficial with the good fat, and perhaps taking something like French fries out of your diet but putting in nuts. So you're switching the type of fat. And that's something we look at doing quite consistently, as well as another area that's been real big as far as the research has been looking at what you can add as far as soluble fibers and things like oatmeal and things like barley, things like beans and peas, and even some simple things like maybe if you're always having rice or pasta or potatoes with a meal, then maybe two or three times a week you switch that. You have black beans one night, or you have barley, which is a much more soluble gummy fiber, in place of one of those grains, or you have chickpeas one night, or hummus or something like that. So you're really looking at adding these soluble fibers in things like beans and peas as well.
So we want to watch how much fat overall we're getting and where the fat is coming from. And then we want to hold back on how much cholesterol we're getting during the course of a day. Add more fiber, and also look at your sodium intake.
Right. When you look at complete full cardiovascular disease risk, of course, high blood pressure is a very high risk factor or really compounds the problem. So two things we see. I mean, often I'll have clients, if they can even drop 5 or 10 pounds, their blood pressure goes down. And so it seems to be quite directly related for some people, not for everyone, but for some people related to weight. And so generally, if we start trying to take a look, just even be more aware of what we're eating, often people will lose weight just because they're kind of watching what they're taking in a little bit more. They're more aware of the foods they're choosing. And, of course, something we always recommend for decreasing risk of cardiovascular disease is eating more fruits and vegetables, particularly fresh ones, so that as you eat more of those foods automatically, we might eat fewer sweets or fewer snack foods because we get more full, we're more satisfied, we have more fiber. And finding the natural nutrients from those fruits and vegetables is just really important when you're looking at trying to stay healthy.
Okay. We've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us now. Let's go and talk with a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is directly related to what you've just said. I'd like to ask about trans fats. I've always thought that they were the same thing as partially hydrogenated fats, but when I look on the packaging of some snack foods like cookies and chips, the front will say 0 grams of trans fat, but then on the back, on the list, under the list of ingredients, one of the items listed is often partially hydrogenated soybean oil. Can you comment on that? And is partially hydrogenated soybean oil not a trans fat?
Well, you ask a lot of very good questions. Excuse me. And it's very confusing, I think, when we look at trans fat. I have one thing I did bring today is a whole review. It's actually from Environmental Nutrition, which is a newsletter I receive, and it's a newsletter for the public as well. And they have a new guide to trans fats because we get a lot of questions in this area. And I'll just read the definition that they have for trans fat. It says, formed when liquid oils are partially hydrogenated into a more solid and more shelf-stable form. Trans fats may increase heart disease risk more than saturated fat, and so on. So basically, trans fats, I think about it as when they start out as more of a liquid type oil, and then they partially hydrogenate them to make them more solid or trans fat. Now, certainly a product could have some partially hydrogenated fat into it, maybe not enough to be counted as trans fat. Or if in some products the saturated fat might be naturally saturated, but they didn't change it over to make it a trans fat, in which case you might see zero trans fat, but itself is saturated or a bit more hardened to begin with. So I think the thing with trans fat that we just want to keep in mind is that when you compare food products, you do want to look at, again, total fat, keeping in mind that about 5 grams is a teaspoon, or I always think about it as a pat of butter. That's about 5 grams of fat. And thinking that the lowest trans fat you have in the product, the better, but also knowing that some foods might naturally have some hydrogenated fat or saturated fat, which also raises lipid levels. So ideally, you'll look at a product, and even if it has fat, or let's say it has 10 grams of fat, very little trans or saturated fat. And then you know you're in pretty good shape. And I think things may be on the label, but just not in high enough amounts to be counted as trans fat, in which case the product you're talking about certainly might be somewhat hydrogenated, which still we recommend the least hydrogenated as possible, but it may not be very much if there's 0 grams of trans fat.
Okay, so I guess from the definition you just read, a trans fat is defined as any fats that are, I guess, probably in liquid form normally under room temperature, but if they hydrogenate it artificially, then it's a trans fat. Is that right?
Right. It's generally where they're changing it, maybe to make the product more shelf stable.
Uh-huh.
I often think about trans fats more in things like cookies and crackers, and those are a lot of the products what we're seeing them taken out of.
Uh-huh.
So many companies can say 0 grams of trans fat. Maybe they're using more full liquid fats and finding other ways to harden the product or other ways to keep it shelf stable as opposed to hardening the fats.
Okay, then I guess I'm still kind of a little bit baffled. Why under the ingredients list, when it says that the chief oil, say in popcorn or potato chips, is partially hydrogenated soybean oil, and no other oils are listed, but then on the front of the packaging it says 0 grams of trans fat.
Right. Well, it's partly, I think, the way that it's processed. Again, maybe, you know, some fats are hydrogenated, you know, have a hydrogenated, basically just hydrogen added to it. So some fats are going to be that way. And they may be naturally more that way. Some maybe have been changed in processing to the point where they do have to be counted. And from my understanding, something might be partially hydrogenated, but just not enough, excuse me, to be counted as a trans fat.
Okay. Should we still avoid, I guess, anything that's any fats that are partially hydrogenated then? Are those considered bad fats?
Well, when you have a hydrogenated fat, again, that is basically taking more of the liquid too, and or it's being a little bit more of a hard fat. But I think what you want to look at is your whole diet. In other words, if you look at that a package of popcorn and it only has 4 or 5 grams of fat and it's partially hydrogenated, even though it's zero trans fat, then I would certainly think that's fine to include in your diet. You may not get, you know, you may not eat everything that looks like that, but that's certainly not that much fat to begin with. So I think part of it is putting it into perspective and seeing the total amount of fat. And if it's not very much, then certainly some foods are going to be somewhat hydrogenated just to maintain their shelf stability. And you'd want to look at everything you're eating and see if, you know, if everything you're having is hydrogenated, yeah, you probably need to cut down. But if you're having a few things that are hydrogenated and more monounsaturated fats or things that are not, then I certainly wouldn't worry about a few products a day.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Mattoon on line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. I have a question. I've been working out regularly, exercising, swimming, walking, wrist walking, and I've been watching my triglycerides. And I find that one time I'll get a reading that's in the high 80s. Next time I might get a reading that's up to 160, 170. Is that just due to the fluctuation in the testing process, or what causes that? And I pretty much eat the same thing.
Well, with triglycerides, they're generally measured most accurately after a fast. And that's why they say after a 12-hour fast, if you're going to look at triglycerides. Triglycerides are, I think of them as a mix of fat and carbohydrate and, you know, kind of sugar and fat together. Triglycerides, tri means three, and then the glycerides are the fatty acids that are off the carbohydrate backbone, if you looked at it kind of, you know, from a chemistry standpoint. And so triglycerides are more the fat that we see kind of carried in the blood that can change more rapidly, because if you do have a very high-fat meal, your triglycerides can go up for a short time and then go back down. And that's why that's one thing that we look at, say, if you're going to have triglycerides tested generally, you have fasted for 12 hours. So occasionally I'll have people who have triglycerides tested on, but they didn't fast, and we might find that they're higher, but then when they're fasting, they're lower because they didn't have a high-fat meal. So some of it might depend on what you eat. Some of it is also looking at the range. I mean, triglycerides, we generally want, you know, 150 or even 200 or below. So if you know that sometimes they're in the 80s, probably your triglycerides are fine because they're not really showing up that high. But they can vary depending upon if you've eaten something, how long it's been. And certainly the testing that we have for lipids is different. I mean, generally you're not going to have the same number every time you go in just because of the differences in testing. And I think because our bodies ebb and flow in terms of what we have in them and how that's going to show up in the testing. I have often had clients who have been tested at one level and then they're tested next month because it doesn't seem like that level was kind of their norm, and then they're back to their norm. Maybe it's 100 points difference even. So I think I don't know what the actual accuracy is if you eat the same thing with the same time period for every test, but I know there is some level of inaccuracy in that too.
Yeah, that's what I experienced, because I pretty much had low-fat meals and fasted for 13 hours, almost the exact time each time, the times I've done it, and it has even been up as high as 225, but then it can be back down to 110 or 86, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It goes these nutty wild swings. And
right, right.
Baffled.
Right. I think, you know, that might be something that, you know, your physician would look at and say, well, if we know it's been high some, we'll want to monitor them too. But I think it's something I've seen every now and then too, of people just going up and down depending upon their own body.
Can eating too much of whole grains for breakfast do that, and not eating them more spaced out during the day?
Well, with triglycerides, one thing that can increase them, or if I'm working with a client with high triglycerides, we do look at total carbohydrate they're taking in. They're, you know, one concern is that if people go on a very low-fat diet, they have high triglycerides, they go on a very low-fat diet, perhaps thinking, you know, and trying to cut down their fat to be healthy for heart health, but they eat a lot more sugar, even if it's whole grain carbohydrate that eventually turns to sugar and their carbohydrate is higher in the diet, then that can increase triglyceride levels. And so one thing that for some people is beneficial with triglycerides is even looking at and switching that a little bit, eating very healthy diet, but then adding more of these good fats we've talked about, adding more salmon and tuna, and even perhaps, you know, in some cases where triglycerides are very high, some physicians will prescribe fish oil supplements because that can be helpful in some cases to bring down triglycerides. But we often look at if anybody has high triglycerides, making sure their carbohydrate isn't too high, no matter what they're eating in carbohydrate, no matter if it's fruit or healthy forms of carbohydrate, but we just make sure that's not too high because that can affect triglycerides.
Can eating a lot of fresh fruit do that? Raise it?
It could if it's enough. You know, if your total carbohydrate is high enough and you're not getting much fat at all, then again, you'd probably, you know, therapeutically, we'd look at saying, well, let's shift that around and make sure that you're also getting plenty of the good fats that may help keep triglycerides down.
And the last question, you mentioned eating oatmeal. Does like a Cheerios type of oat serve the same purpose as oatmeal, or is it the oatmeal that you really need to get in a meal form?
Well, it's actually the soluble fiber, or what we call beta-glucan, which is found in the oats. And so Cheerios, or some type of oat cereal like that, has the beta-glucan. It doesn't have as much per cup, and so maybe you'd be looking at, say, 3 cups of Cheerios might be the same as about a cup of cooked oats, as far as the amount of that soluble fiber, or even a cup and a half of cooked oats is maybe 3 cups of actual Cheerios. So if you look at it, the calories might be pretty similar because Cheerios are pretty low calorie and oatmeal's a little bit more dense in calories. But that's about the difference in the soluble fiber. So you can get it from Cheerios. You just have to eat more of it to get the same amount of this soluble fiber.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jen.
Thanks for the call. To follow up on that last question, that's interesting. Help me remember, soluble fiber, is that the same as sticky fiber?
Right. That's more what you'd think of as sticky fiber or gummy fiber. Or, you know, if you look at something cooked like oats and you see how kind of gooey they are, and you look at barley and you look at beans, and those tend to have more of the soluble fiber than something like, let's say, bran flakes, which is more of a wheat bran, which is more insoluble, which is the type of fiber that helps with constipation and keeping you regular, whereas the gummy fiber may play more of a role with keeping down blood cholesterol levels.
Okay, so you want a mix of both of those types of fiber in your diet.
Right. And fruits and vegetables generally have both. There are some fruits, for instance, that may have more soluble, like apples and pears. Berries may have a little bit more. But if you eat a lot of different fruits and vegetables, you're probably getting good soluble and insoluble fiber. And then part of it is just choosing your grains, maybe, and looking at some of those things that might be better choices for this gummy fiber.
Okay, very good. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Bourbonnais on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have several questions, if you please, and two of them revolve around packaging of foods. Hello?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Several years ago, it was the case that in bottled water, the water in those plastic bottles would leach chemicals out of the plastic. Is that still true?
Well, not as far as I know, but I'm not a packaging expert. I mean, I think in general, the whole area of packaging is certainly, the whole area is really looked to making sure that the way foods are packaged are healthy for us, and make sure that there aren't problems with leaching and problems with nutrient malabsorption or anything like that. So as far as I know, that's something that's always being looked at in the area of food packaging and how to try to enhance that so that it can, you know, we can retain the nutrients as well as possible within the foods, but not cause any harm. But I know there are still a lot of people who have been concerned about plastics in general, you know, and are we too exposed to plastics, whether that's in food or other issues too. And certainly there's a whole area that's looking at that.
Okay. Well, my next question is very similar. If I drink something out of an aluminum can, pop or water or whatever, am I drinking liquid that has been in direct contact with aluminum, or is there some kind of liner, maybe even a plastic liner or lining, on the inside of that can?
Well, I don't think generally if you use the products within the dates that are recommended that you're at risk for having any problem like that. I think the way that they're packaged is supposed to prevent any problem with that. I do tell people that occasionally they'll say that they've eaten something, a canned product, you know, and maybe it's 5 years past the date and they feel like it, you know, seems like it tastes funny and things like that. And so some of that may be if a food is exposed for too long, or we do know that if you open up a can of something and you have it then open in the refrigerator and it's a metal can or a tin can, that you want to put that into a different container. You don't want to have that exposed to air because of the oxidizing of some of the nutrients and how that might interact with the can. But in general, I think if you go by the dates, then certainly there are a lot of regulations to make sure that we maximize the safety of the food.
Okay, so that same principle would apply to canned drinks like pop or beer or something?
Well, sure. I mean, I can't imagine that there's any, you know, could be any real problem if you're drinking something within the recommended date. I don't know those exact regulations since I don't really work in that area, but you know, I know that just for general food safety purposes, that's something that's obviously looked at too.
Okay, thank you. If I take a vitamin C supplement or something that's fortified with vitamin C, where does that vitamin C come from?
It could come from a lot of different things. You might see supplements that say rose hips, or supplements that say bioflavonoids, or have different type of, you know, more chemically formulated vitamin C. So it really could, it's generally going to vary depending upon what that supplement is or what's listed on the label in terms of the product that's in there or the chemical that may be in there.
Are there any that derive their vitamin C from oranges and grapefruit and so forth?
Oh, I think there are. I mean, you know, you'll see food products and even supplements that say that they're more whole food products and whole fruit products and fruit and vegetable based supplements where some of those nutrients come, or maybe all of them in some cases, are going to come from the natural fruits and vegetables themselves. And so there are those types of products or supplements that are available, or you'll find vegan products that basically everything will come from more of a, you know, a non-animal source, or will come from a fruit and vegetable source. And so those things certainly are available too.
When they do that, does that consume the orange, or is there like pulp or something left that then goes into some other product?
I'm not really sure how they do that. I mean, I know generally what they'll market is maybe a powdered form of some of the phytochemicals or nutrients that are in that fruit or vegetable itself. But I don't know exactly what they do or how they get that.
Okay, thank you. What is the definition of natural flavors? I mean, we see that a lot on packages of stuff. But what does that mean? What is a legal natural flavor?
Well, I think when you look at natural flavor, I mean, it could mean a lot of different things. I think there are some of these food components or things that we see on products that or have more of a legal sense, and some of them don't. I mean, generally, I think the implication of a natural, you know, a natural flavoring would maybe come from a food itself or come from an herb itself. But as far as when we see that, natural is kind of, you know, as far as I understand it, it's one of those words that could have a lot of different meanings, you know.
Well, what's an unnatural flavor?
Right. It's very difficult to tell with some of these wordings.
What is the latest with the standardization of the term organic?
Well, that's still being looked at. I mean, right now, certainly when the organic label, when we were able to actually say what organic was and have that on the label, that was a big plus. And I think that's partly why the organic foods industry has really boomed, because now we have more standardization. And I think that may be something that is continually reviewed and continually looked at. But right now, people can be assured that organic is organic, and so it's organically produced, or it's produced without additional chemicals. And I think people are looking for that. I read something the other day that I think organic is still just maybe 2% of all the products on the shelves. So it's very small, although more and more people are interested in that.
I know some months ago there was a thrust to define organic beef, if I recall, is beef that had been fed organic food, you know, only a certain percentage of it, or only it could have been months before.
Right.
Something like that.
Right. I think, you know, I think we'll continue to see this whole organic area be, you know, changing and being looked at, And as we're able to, you know, develop more recommendations, we're going to be looking at that more closely as well.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Susan Kundrat is our guest this afternoon here on the program. She's a registered dietitian. She joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. I want to thank the listener for his questions this afternoon and invite others to join us if you have a question about diet, nutrition, and or exercise. Give us a call. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Susan is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Frequently contributes to magazines on health and fitness, and she's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find her on the web at www.eatandmove.com. That's EatandMove.com. Well, back to heart health. You know, a lot is being made about whole grains.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something else we see now more and more on labels. And it's kind of tricky because whole grains are, there's a whole wide range of whole grains out
right
there. How do we make sense of you know, what kinds of whole grains we should be including in the diet?
Well, you know, naturally, if we think about whole grains and what the grain is, it would be the grain itself being basically maybe even eating it by itself, let's say, with rye berries that you can get in bulk and just cook that. That's the whole grain. It's actually the grain. It's the full grain. Or if something is broken down or used as a flour, then they actually take the whole seed or the whole kernel and break that down. So you're getting the benefit from all of the grain. I mean, usually the grain, you know, is generally the inside part or the endosperm, maybe the softer mm-hmm part, and that might be if you have white bread, you're using primarily that. But if you have the whole bran on the outside and the germ and you're using everything, then that would be considered the whole grain. And so generally I tell people look for 100% whole whatever it is. Maybe it's whole oat or whole bran or 100% whole wheat or whole oat. And so if you know, look for those, then you know that you've got the complete grain. And so what you're getting is more B vitamins. You're generally getting more fiber. You're generally getting more of the, the natural nutrients that are going to be found in there too. And so the other thing you can look at is also look at the fiber amount on there.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it is a whole grain, then generally it's going to have more fiber. And so with breads, for instance, which is still quite confusing for people to mm-hmm look at and see what's out there, one recommendation I make is at least 2 grams of fiber, because generally you're going to be getting mostly whole grain in a bread if it is generally mm-hmm 2 grams of fiber or more. And now we have different types of products and companies that have, you know, bagels that have 8 grams of fiber, or it's basically almost all whole grain. And sometimes they add extra fiber back into it from other sources as well. But that's something that just is another way. If you're confused about breads, let's say, then you look and you compare the fiber amount.
Okay.
Thanks. And that's helpful.
Thanks for that, because mm-hmm it's so confusing.
It's
because,
very,
you know, a bowl of rye berries is a different whole grain than white bread that says whole grain on it.
Right, yeah, right.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. Another caller joining us this afternoon from Mattoon on line 4. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. The previous caller did kind of trigger a question I've been looking for an answer to for a while when it comes to natural flavorings. And that's, do you have any information as to what happened to the move to make all products containing MSG to clearly state that they contain MSG? I know it's a natural occurring product, and so a lot of food packagers just hide it by calling it a natural flavoring.
Well, I think, and I'm not totally up on where that is right now, but I think many food manufacturers are careful to list it because they certainly want people to know if it's actually in there, and there are a lot of people who have trouble with it. So I think we're seeing that might be, you know, and again, I can't comment on that because I'm not sure where that is legality-wise. But generally, you can, if you're careful with looking at the labels, you'll find that on there. Monosodium glutamate usually is the way it's listed on the label. But you'll also see a lot of products now that will say no MSG, especially if it's something that you might naturally find it in. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and that's really become the key, because that is an issue in our household, is an allergy to MSG. And it's just been bitten too many times by things labeled as natural flavoring. So you almost have to look for the one that specifically says no MSG. And then, you know, it still may say natural flavors, but, you know, it apparently was supposed to have been an FDA requirement. I'm just wondering if maybe the food industry didn't carry enough clout to kind of push that back down the priority list.
Yeah, I will find out about that. I'm not really sure where that is. But like you're saying, I think your best bet is to look specifically. Does it either say it's specifically in it, or does it say specifically that there is no MSG to be sure with a product? Because as you know, as we're saying, the term natural really could mean all kinds of things. And so that doesn't tell us a whole lot.
All righty. Well, thank you for your time.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Piatt County on line two. Hi.
Hello. I have a question concerning broccoli, a couple of questions, actually. Number one, I read in Prevention Magazine that microwaving broccoli destroys its antioxidant properties, but that's confusing, because then wouldn't that be the same for all vegetables?
Well, there have been some studies on broccoli. Some of the researchers have done the work here at University of Illinois, actually, and I think one of the studies that I can think of that wasn't done too long ago did look at the comparison with how it was cooked and the most beneficial way that the nutrients would be available. And certainly in general, like is in general with most fruits and vegetables, if you eat it fresh, that's probably the best way to get it. But for a lot of people, they can't do that. So it seems to be a real difference with the amount of cooking you have, too, and the length, and how much in general a vegetable is exposed to the water. And so, you know, something like broccoli, I think, if it is microwave, what I tell people is if you're going to microwave it, do it for a short time and maybe just have a little bit of water in there, enough that it will steam cook it very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the study that I'm thinking of, too, they also steam vegetables for different amounts of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, steaming it for a short amount of time when it's not actually in the water, you know, if you look in general at fruits and vegetables, there are some nutrients that are going to be more available if the food is broken down a little bit. And some nutrients are going to be less available if it's cooked. And what seems to be kind of consistent with most foods is that if it's not sitting in water, if it's not exposed and a lot of the nutrients go out and leach into the water, then you're better shape. And if you're cooking it or steaming it for shorter periods of time. And so not everybody can eat broccoli raw, and it bothers a lot of people. And so I think you just look at that continuum of how much are you going to cook it and how long and how exposed is it to fluid. And that's a good way to kind of try and enhance the nutrients. I think one thing that has been pretty controversial lately, and I was just reading something about this last week, was, you know, really we look a lot at particular antioxidants and which ones are most available and whether that's actually in a lab or whether that's in the food itself that we're going to be eating. Some of it depends on which nutrient you look at. And so vitamin C in some ways might be more enhanced if you cook it a little bit. Maybe it's not, and other nutrients might be more available if they're cooked a little bit. Otherwise not. So it gets really confusing. So I think, in a general sense, you think, well, eat them fresh when you can.
Mm-hmm.
Buy them maybe that they're smaller and they're not bruised and foods that really, I think at the store we have to really be sleuths almost, because I know when I pick produce, I really try to be careful and pick the ones that I think are behind. Usually they're fresher than the ones right up front. And you try to make sure there aren't bruises on some of the fruits and vegetables. And you try to make sure that I generally look for smaller ones that maybe aren't as big, that aren't as old.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if you can buy locally, that's great.
Yeah.
And if you can buy generally organic, then that maybe have other benefits. And so you kind of look at all the things that you could do.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest thing, though, is to eat them. Because even if it's cooked, you're still going to get tons of nutrients from broccoli. No question about it.
Well, that's my next question, then, is that I do like broccoli raw, but I also wonder, I like to peel the stalks and use them like celery. Does that have the same benefit, or is it just the fibrous part of the head?
Well, no, there's certainly benefit in the stalks as well, and there are different nutrients that may be in the flowerets than actually in the stalks, or different concentrations of nutrients, I should say. But I say, too, anything you eat is going to be a benefit. You know, any vegetable and fruit you eat is going to benefit you. It's going to have some nutritional value. And so that's great if you can eat the stalks, too, and that's a great way to do it, to eat it kind of as a snack like celery or something.
Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Next, we're going to go and talk with a listener, I believe, in Sullivan on line four. Hello.
Yes. good afternoon. My question is, I'm borderline high cholesterol from natural. I've inherited that from my parents, and I've been trying to control it with just diet. And whenever I look at nutrition labels, I always look at saturated fat and the total fats and everything. What's the kind of a guideline that you want to stay away from, say, if it's over a certain percentage or something like this on foods? Do you have a guideline?
Mm-hmm.
To stay?
Okay. Yes. And I think that's a question that people often have is how do you decide if a product is something you really should eat or shouldn't eat, or how
right.
much of it should you eat?
Right.
And, again, you look at your total meal, because you might have something that's higher in fat or saturated fat, but you're eating it with fruits and veggies and whole grains, and so it's not a big problem. But in general, we kind of look at the guideline of about 30% of the total fat, 30% of the total calories or less from fat. And then ideally, 10% of that would be saturated fat. So if you look at a product and say, well, it has 20 grams of fat, you know, ideally maybe 2 or 3 grams of that. If that's saturated fat, that's not too bad. But of course, 20 grams of fat is a lot of fat to begin with. So when we look at our general recommendations of somewhere around, 60 to 65 grams of fat a day, and no more than a third of that is saturated, that would be 20 or 25 grams or so. And all those recommendations are general, and it would really depend on your own calorie needs and things.
Right.
But really, we try to keep that down to a third or so, total in your total diet of what you're taking in. So, it is kind of tricky to figure that out. But you look at a product, for instance, and if most of the fat is not saturated fat, then that's a good sign. And again, if the first on the label, if the first thing you hear is not, or first thing you see is not hydrogenated fat, that's a good sign.
Yeah.
And so that's all going to be pretty helpful to you in terms of making those recommendations.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon. I suppose after you work at it for a little while, it becomes a little easier, but getting your feet wet.
Right.
Trying to sort it all out can be kind of confusing. But so you want to look at the breakdown percentages of things, for example, how many calories from fat, how many calories sat fat, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And then so that label is useful. And then down below in the finer print
right.
is going to have your list of ingredients, and it should be the main ingredient, so to speak. The smaller the amount of the ingredient in the product, it should come at the end of the list.
Right. The farther down it'll be.
Okay. Very good.
Exactly. And needs, what's tricky too is that needs really are based on individual people. So if we look at a food label, it's an average of 2,000 calories, but you might be needing 3,000 calories if you're real active. And so really your fat needs certainly could be higher. And then it does get very confusing, because then you to try to keep that down to, let's say, 20 grams of saturated fat a day, or keep that down, is a little bit more tricky to do that.
Yeah. There are some tools, though, on the internet and in book form at the library that can help people
right.
sort
right.
through it. Okay, let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana on line one. You're on the air with Susan Kundrat. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Interesting program. I have two questions. I've come in the last year or so, I enjoy roasting vegetables, tossing them with olive oil, maybe a little sea salt, and roasting them at 425 degrees for a while, including broccoli, which creates a very interesting nutty flavor. And I'm just curious about your take on roasted vegetables. And then the other thing that I really have tried and dislike is whole wheat pastas. And they don't seem to cook well. I've read some articles that recommend one brand over another, but I still, like my good old 100% Durum semolina, plain old white pasta. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, to answer your first question about roasting vegetables, I think, again, the vegetables may be, they're going to be exposed to heat for longer periods of time, so some of the nutrients might be lower, but you're still going to get good benefit from the vegetables. And then generally, if you roast it, like you're saying, with olive oil, then you get the benefit from some additional good fat. And so I think that's certainly a great option as
tastes
a way to taste great. I know.
So you're going to eat them.
That's right. That's the thing. You'll probably eat more. And of course, when they roast, they kind of get smaller. And so you do find that you can have larger portions. So that's I think that's perfectly acceptable and a good way to eat more vegetables and as an option of a way to get them in. And I think your answer, you know, your question with the pasta, I get that thought a lot, that people just don't like whole grain, the whole wheat pasta. And, of course, the texture is different. Like you're saying, it cooks differently and the mouthfeel is all different. And so one thing that some people like and that I've tried that helps some is sometimes I'll mix whole grain pasta with, you know, the regular white pasta or the regular durum pasta. And that helps some. And in other ways, I think, well, you don't have to eat every grain that's whole grain. So if you really enjoy pasta and you enjoy the way it tastes and the feel, and then that might not be something that would be really a good choice for you for a whole grain. And it wouldn't have to be, because that might be one. It's certainly fortified. It's enriched. It's going to have a lot of other nutrients in it. And pasta is good for you, you know. And so that might be one that doesn't have as much fiber. But then certainly you're having whole wheat bread and you're having beans and you're having other things that are going to get you more fiber and whole grains. And that would be certainly really fine. It's part of a total healthy diet.
Great. Well, thank you for your comments. I appreciate it.
Okay. Next, we talk with a listener on line 2 in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. My question has to do with fish oils as supplements, and especially considering that a lot of fish now are, you know, we're concerned about mercury and other toxins, and I'm curious if you have any knowledge about the processing that fish oil as supplements goes through, if we can know for sure that they don't contain any mercury or other toxins. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, this has definitely been a big issue and a big concern for people. And there are some organizations and some groups out there that have been testing different supplements, including fish oils. And so one thing I would highly recommend is checking the website it's just Consumer Lab. It's just www.consumerlab.com. And that's a website that does these reviews, and they periodically pick supplements off the shelves, and they'll test them to make sure that what they have, you know, on the label is exactly what they have, and they don't have any contaminants or anything. And so that's a really good place to get. Actually, you can get a listing on that website of supplements that have passed their test and have what they say in them. You'll see all kinds of different marketing techniques for fish oils, saying that these are better than those, and cold water processed and all these things. And I think that getting some type of, you know, recommendation from an outside organization that looks at these is a good idea. So I'd highly recommend that as a way to get some examples of different companies that do not have mercury and have been tested. And I think I really don't know exactly how the different processing is and if different companies use different processing. I think partly what they'll market is where they've got the fish to begin with and whether that would be more of a source that would be less apt to have mercury than some other sources. But certainly the area of fish oils and using fish oils for inflammation, for, like say, with cardiovascular disease and other things, has really, people have gotten much greater interest, and I certainly have had more people who have seen benefit if they've needed it. So, but I would check that consumerlab.com.
Okay, let's talk with one more listener this afternoon before we have to wrap things up, but we'll have to be quick. Vermilion County, line 4, hi.
Hi. Someplace I had heard that it's preferable to eat steel-cut oats rather than regular oats. Do you have any explanation as to why that might be, or is it important?
Well, the steel-cut oats are probably the most natural form of oats in terms of being pretty much just the oats, the whole grain, and they're not as processed. There's some thought that if it is more kind of a larger oat or a whole grain like that, as opposed to being maybe, thinner or smaller pieces, that maybe itself might help manage blood sugar better or things. But I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I think if you get more of just a regular oatmeal that doesn't have anything else added to it, then you're in great shape. The steel-cut oats generally are a little bit chewier, maybe a little bit, feel like you've got a little bit more fiber in there, and the fiber might be a little bit higher, but it's just really more the way that the oat is processed. If you get 100% whole grain oats in, you know, Quaker oatmeal, it's just natural Quaker oatmeal too, then that certainly would be beneficial as well.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, there we will wrap it up. And again, a reminder to folks listening this afternoon that Susan has brought in some information about cholesterol, and we'll be happy to pass that along to folks if they would send us a self-addressed stamped envelope to WILL Radio, the Afternoon Magazine, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, 61801. Maybe next time when you're here, we'll talk a little bit about cholesterol and exercise. That's part of the equation we didn't touch on this afternoon.
Bet.
Okay, very good. Well, will we see you in December?
See you in December.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank
Susan
you.
Susan Kundrat, sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields has an in-store nutritionist, provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce.
It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. In the wheat pit, December fell to new contract lows today. The new low is 309.25. The previous low was 310. Market pressured by quiet exports over the weekend. In the corn pit, we also saw a new contract low, lows in the near four-by months. December, the new low of 194.25 below the low of 195, which was set overnight. In the soybean pit, January gap lower, opening below its 50-day moving average. That was 590.5 per bushel. Futures remained under pressure all day from the harvest this year. The big U.S. soybean crop predicted to be above 3 billion bushels by the trade on Thursday's USDA crop production report, as well as traders worried about concerns over bird flu. This morning it was revealed in China that around Beijing they have culled more than 6 million birds in an attempt to stem the tide of avian influenza. Let's go ahead and look at the current tick for you. And as we do, we begin in the wheat pit. Settlement prices there for the December contract, a high of 313.5, a low of 308.75, settling at 310, down 1.25. March, a high of 328.75, a low of 324.5, settling 325.75, down 1.5. May, a high of 338, a low of 334, settling 334.75, down 1.25. July, 346.5, a low of 342.5, settling 343.25, down 1.75. September, also down 1.75. On the day, the high there, 354, the low 351, settling 352.25. December corn, a high of 195.25, a low of 194.25, settling 194.75, down 3/4. March, a high of 209.75, a low of 208.75, settling 209.5, down 1/4. May, a high of 217.75, a low of 217, settling 217.5, down 1/4. July, a high of 225.25, a low of 224.25, settling 224.75, down 1/4. September, a high of 233.5, a low of 232.5, settling 233.5, unchanged on the day. And then the one bright spot on the trading floor at the Chicago Board of Trade in the grains pits, the December red line contract, a high on the day of 245.25, low of 243.75, settling 245 up 1/4 on the day. December oats, a high of 167.75, a low of 165.25, settling 165.5, down 2.25. November beans, a high of 577, a low of 570.5, settling 571.5, down 9. January, a high of 588, a low of 582.5, settling 583, down 9. March, a high of 596, a low of 591, settling 591.5, down 9. May, a high of 601.5, a low of 598, settling 598.5, down 7.75. July, a high of 607, a low of 604, settling 604.25, down 6.75. August, a high of 608.5, a low of 606.5, settling 606.75, down 4.25. And the November contract, a high of 613, a low of 609.5, settling 611.5, down 5.5. December soybean meal, a high of 175.50, a low of 173, settling 174.10, down 210. January, a high of 177, a low of 174.80, settling 175.40, down 240. December soybean oil, a high of 22.85, a low of 22.65, settling 22.67, down 27. January, a high of 23.07, a low of 22.87, settling 22.89, down 28 on the day. One quick programming reminder, be sure to join us this evening for another one of our free AM 580 Agricultural Outlook panels. We'll be at the Radisson Hotel at 10 Brickyard Drive in Bloomington, Illinois at 7 o'clock. Panelists include Mike Zuzolo of Risk Management, Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield, Bill Mayer of Roach Ag, and Clayton Pope of Clayton Pope Commodities. And we do indeed hope to see you there. No reservation required. Bring your questions and get them answered. Settlement prices also in over on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And Celeste, unlike at the board, it was an up day.
Another up day for the Merc. November feeder cattle, the one exception among the contracts that we keep track of here. November feeder cattle, 116.15 the high, 115.80 the low, 116.02.5 the settlement, that down a nickel. Again, that was the only contract that finished lower today. January feeder cattle, 114.90 the high, 114.50 the low, the settlement, 114.77.5, that up 12.5. March, 112.35 the high, 111.80 the low, the settlement, 112.30, that up 37.5. December live cattle, 91.95 the high, 91.35 the low, 91.80 the settlement, that up 32.5. February live cattle, 94.75 the high, 94.15 the low, 94.65 the settlement, that finishing up 40. December lean hog, 64.25 the high, 62.30 the low, the settlement, 63.75, that up 147.5. February, 67.97.5 the high, 66.35 the low, 67.75 the settlement, that up 142.5. April lean hog, 68.85 the high, 67.20 the low, 68.72.5 the settlement, that up 170. May lean hog, 69.25 the high, 68.25 the low, the settlement today for May lean hog, 69.17.5, that was up 92.5. And February pork bellies, today's high 91.70, the low 89.50. February bellies finished at 91.17.5, that up 237.5. The Dow is up 55 points at 10,585. The NASDAQ 10 higher at 2180. The S&P 500 up 3 points at 1223.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
While the attention is on Iraq and Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa may be the most important front in the war on terror.
You can't change a culture, but you can influence it. This is where we're going to win, is right here.
But the region is flooded with weapons and plagued by porous borders, corrupt regimes, and endemic poverty. Our series on the Horn of Africa begins later.